From WHYY in Philadelphia, happy Thanksgiving. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Well, I washed all the dishes and I did a lot more. I even bought the dinner at the grocery store. And now, Mom, you're buying the key next door. This little girl's gonna rock it.
On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. She died last week at the age of 78. She was one of Atlantic Records' first big stars, with a string of top 10 R&B hits in the 50s, including Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. Her record, This Little Girl's Gone Rockin', which we're listening to now, was recently used on a Hummer TV ad. We'll also feature an interview with playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon, the winner of this year's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I want to start by wishing you a happy Thanksgiving. On this holiday edition, we're going to listen back to an interview with Neil Simon. Last month, he was awarded the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. The Kennedy Center ceremony was broadcast earlier this week on many public TV stations. Simon started his career in the early days of television, writing for Sid Caesar's Show, Phil Silver's Sergeant Bilko, and The Gary Moore Show. But his real ambition was to write plays, and he sure succeeded. His hits include Come Blow Your Horn, Barefoot in the Park, Plaza Suite, Prisoner of Second Avenue, The Sunshine Boys, The Goodbye Girl, California Suite, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Biloxi Blues, and Laughter on the 23rd Floor. He also wrote the book for the musicals Sweet Charity and Promises, Promises. Simon adapted many of his plays into successful films. The popular movie and TV series The Odd Couple were adapted from his hit play. The movie starred Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon as two divorced men sharing an apartment, having the same kinds of problems with each other they used to have with their wives.
Oscar, what is it? Is it the cooking or the cleaning, the crying?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. The cooking, the cleaning, the crying. It's the talking in your sleep. It's those moose calls that open your ears at 2 o'clock in the morning. Can't take it anymore, Felix. I'm cracking up. Everything you do irritates me. And when you're not here, the things I know you're gonna do when you come in irritate me. You leave me little notes on my pillow. Told you 158 times I cannot stand little notes on my pillow. We are all out of cornflakes, F.U. Took me 3 hours to figure out that F.U. was Felix Unger.
I spoke with Neil Simon in 1996, when the first volume of his memoirs, Rewrites, had just been published. The second volume, The Play Goes On, came out in 2002. Early on in your career, your brother Danny was your writing partner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, what, about 8 years older?
Eight and a half years older, yes.
Yeah. And you write in your book that he was somewhere between your brother and your father. He was your mentor as well as your mm-hmm. brother. And your father actually was in and out of the family. He left the family and came back, I think, about eight times.
Exactly, yes.
Was it strange to have him coming and going like that, not knowing exactly what his relationship to you was?
It was awful because I felt my life was sort of on a yo-yo, to give my kind of example. My mother never knew when he was coming back, and the whole world lit up when he came back, because it meant not only that we'd not have to fear for the rent, because he didn't leave any money for us, we didn't have to worry about food, but I felt a solidity there with the family, and I felt happy for my mother. When he was gone, it was the most awful time, and I thought he was never coming back. And I'm sure a lot of my personality has been formed by that relationship, and it makes me somewhat insecure at times. And it's why I think I fell back on writing, possibly, as a way of being able to support and survive for myself.
I imagine your mother, when your father was gone, ended up very busy with earning money. Earning money to take care of the family.
Yes, she was uneducated. Mm-hmm. She did not have a job, and she would do whatever she could to provide for us. She borrowed from her family, but what she eventually did, which was the hardest thing for us, was she took in two men to live in our house, two boarders, who took her bedroom, and she slept on the sofa in the living room. My brother and I had our own bedroom. And they were butchers, and they paid us mostly in meat and lamb chops. it was no fun sitting at the room in the kitchen eating with them.
Why not?
They were like strangers. They didn't talk to us. They were mostly foreigners, and I don't mean mostly foreigners. They were foreign and spoke some English, but it was difficult, and it was not my father, and I felt I was living in not my house but their house.
You know, the stereotype of the Jewish mother of your mother's generation was of the overly possessive, overly neurotic Jewish mother, right? I imagine your mother was much too busy.
She was.
To fit that stereotype at all.
No, I don't think she did fit that stereotype. She was very different. She was very loving and very encouraging in terms of my brother and I doing the writing. My brother, foolishly, I think, would read the monologues that we would write at first to my mother, and she would just laugh all the way through. And my brother said, "Do you understand what they mean?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, why are you laughing?" She says, "Well, it pleases me to please you." I mean, it was such a wonderful thing for her to do. It didn't encourage us as writers, but it encouraged us that we had a terrific mother.
You write that your brother got you a whore shortly after your 21st birthday, and that was your sexual initiation.
Yes, it was.
Looking back, was that a good way to become initiated?
I don't know if it was a good way. It was the only way. I mean, if he left it to me, I'd be 54 before it happened. I'm sure glad it did happen. But it did change me. I mean, you have to get through that moment, because it was the most fearful moment of my life. And I don't know why it is, looking back. I mean, that you don't expect this woman to think that you should be expert at what you're doing, or that this is going to be a very personal affair and that we should like each other. It's really a cash and carry business, and you just do it. But I felt so much better having done it, and that I would never have to do it that way again, which I never did.
There's a similar but different scene in Biloxi Blues, where the character there also has his first experience with a prostitute, but that's on an army base, so it's...
Yeah, but the origin of that scene in that film was exactly what happened to me. I mean, it was with a prostitute.
Yeah.
It was his fellow friends bringing him there, but he was... There was a line in it that summed it up, because I felt the same way when it happened to me. He said, I'm not expecting this to be a pleasurable experience. I just want to get through it.
Let me ask you about creating two of your most famous characters, Felix and Oscar, the odd couple.
Yes.
How did you come up with those characters?
Well, I just watched it in real life. It was my brother, Danny, and a friend of his named Roy Gerber, both of whom moved in together in the same apartment because they recently were divorced. And they wanted to cut down on their expenses so they could help pay their alimony. And in their social life, rather than going out on a double date somewhere and spending a lot of money on the dinner, my brother Danny decided to cook. And Roy was kind of a, you know, things came and go very easily for him. So he would just say to the girls, come out for dinner. Come, you know, 6:30, 7, 7:30, whenever you're ready. Well, to Danny, that was anathema. I mean, he was... He cooked the pot roast that night. He wanted them there at 7:30. And I watched this one night. I came up to Danny's apartment and Roy's apartment. I saw this taking place as they were getting prepared for this dinner. I was going to leave before the dinner happened. And it was hilarious to me. And I said, Danny, this is a great movie, a great play, something. You must write it, because Danny was a writer too. But he never wrote by himself. And he started to write the play, but he took 3 months or so to write 10 pages. And finally called me and he said, I can't do it. He says, I'm not a writer and I'm certainly not a playwright. He is a writer, of course, but he was not a playwright and he didn't know how to construct it. And he said, you take the play and you do it. And so I made a financial arrangement with him because it was his basic, it wasn't his idea to do it as a play, but it was his life. So I was taking a part of it. When I wrote the play in the beginning, I thought I was writing a very dark comedy. I didn't think it was going to be as funny as it was dark, because he was a man who was broken up with his wife that he loved dearly, and he had to leave his two children at home, and he was almost suicidal. Whereas Roy was another kind of character who was, I mean, the character that Roy was based on, the Oscar character, was a man who couldn't really keep his life going together, didn't know how to take care of his children's goldfish when they left. And so I thought I was writing, as I said, this grim comedy until... I gave it to Bob Fosse, a good friend of mine who lived in the same building, to read. And he says, this is the funniest play I've ever read. And I said, you don't find it dark? And he said, no, not at all. So the author is not always sure about what impression he's going to leave when he writes this thing.
Now, how'd you feel about The Odd Couple when it became a TV series, where instead of like a constructed play every week, there was another little adventure or mishap to write
well,
around?
Well, I have to preface that by telling you the story, which you may have read in the book, that I had a business agent who thought he was doing me a favor by getting a deal made with Paramount Pictures, whereby they would buy this little company from me for $125,000, which seemed like an enormous amount of money, in which they got all of the TV and television rights to The Odd Couple. So I never saw a penny of any of The Odd Couple television series. So I could not watch that. I didn't watch that for 2 years, because when I saw that it was a hit, I saw that's my money going down their drain.
Right.
And I also lost all of the stage rights of Barefoot in the Park. Never made a penny on that play from the day it opened. And so I looked at that as a very bad experience, and it was hard for me to watch the show until I finally did see it about 2 years after it was running, and I saw how good it was. It was really good. Didn't do me any good, but it's okay for them.
Oh, boy, what heartburn it must cause to feel that you almost don't want to see the success of your own work because you're not getting anything out of it.
I know. It was hard, but maybe just pushed me on to do other things, and I said, I've got to get on with this. I'm not going to sit and just gripe about it for the rest of my life, and I just went on to write other plays.
You say that you have always followed the advice of Max Gordon, who said, think of characters, not stories or plots. Why is that good advice?
Because that's what a play is about. There are very few plays that are about a plot. Movies are made about plots. Television shows are about plots. If you go to a movie studio today and bring a script and they start to read it and they'll say, oh, I see, this is character-driven, isn't it? Which is a negative to them. I grew up reading many, many books. I got pulled into the stories by the characters, as I did with the early films that I saw, the characters that Humphrey Bogart played or even a Leslie Howard or any of the great actors. That's what I was attracted to.
My guest is Neil Simon. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1996 interview with playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. Last month, he was awarded the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. The Kennedy Center ceremony was broadcast this week on many PBS stations. You write a little bit in your book about being in analysis, and you say that your first year of analysis was, in a sense, an attempt to introduce you to yourself, the two sides of you, one the writer and the other the person who doesn't write. Are these two sides of you at odds?
Well, they have been for years. They weren't always at odds. They were just different people. They were not the person that I was with my family, with my friends. The writer is a very solitary person who is, I guess in the worst sense, willing to pick the bones of somebody else's character and put it up there on the stage, even though I don't think I've ever hurt anybody by doing it because no one ever came up to me and said, how dare you put this up there on the stage? As a matter of fact, when I put my father up on the stage and Come Blow Your Horn, he came to see it, and I was very fearful of what he was going to say. And I said, what'd you think, Dad? And he says, oh, I know men just like that. He never saw himself in it at all, which is what most people do. Sometimes they people come up to me and they say, that was me you were writing about, wasn't it? And it wasn't at all anything that I was writing about. So about the two Neil Simons, yes. The writer was persistent. He just always wanted to write. The other person wanted to have more fun, more leisure time, more time with his family. And so they were at odds. But I find as time goes on, right about now, maybe as we're talking, that the two characters are becoming more wed to each other. I don't see the disparity in the two personalities anymore. It sounds like I'm a little psychotic, but I'm not really.
Well, maybe that's because the two have lived together for so long, they've become more acclimated to each other.
I know. I'm my own odd couple.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Did analysis help?
Well, analysis, I think, helps in the long run. I never went for, like, long, long periods at a time. I would go from time to time when there was great trouble in my life, when my first wife died, when I had other personal problems. But after a while, I started to go because it was a way of learning about myself and about learning about other people, because the conversations were not only about this Neil Simon character. It was about how they are affected by other people in the world. And once you get into that subject, you start to talk about the other people in the world and you realize that you do not live alone in this world. So it was very educational for me. I graduated, got a diploma. It was very nice.
Was it helpful for you as a writer to introspect out loud like that?
I think so. The one thing it helped me to do was open myself up to a complete stranger, because I went to different analysts during my life, and I never had any trouble doing it. I know people who would say, oh, I would never tell that to my analyst. And I said, what are you going for? I was never afraid that they were going to betray my privacy or that they were going to dig too deep. I was sometimes afraid that I was going to go someplace that was so dark and deep in myself that it might throw me. But it never did. I never found that place that was so awful. I just realized that I was human and I was subject to human experiences and troubles and travails and a lot of happiness. If anything, the annals may have taught me to try to enjoy my life so much. One of them said, "Neil, you don't enjoy your successes long enough." And I said, "Well, how you mean to play?" And she says, "Yes. I mean, you go around for about 3 or 4 days and say, this is great. And then you just go back to work and you forget about it." And I said, "Well, you have to tell me how long I'm supposed to enjoy myself." It's work to me, and I enjoy the work, so I'm enjoying the work more than I am the success.
I thought a kind of funny part of your book was, I guess it's the late 60s, early 70s, you were writing about the era of the so-called sexual revolution, and you were married, but you wanted in.
I wanted to be a part of this. Yeah, it wasn't the sexual revolution so much. I'd been married for 14 years, and I thought, I was looking at myself in a different way, and I said, you got married fairly young. I had very, very few experiences, except in the Grimm Hotel. And I was not looking, I didn't want to go out cheating on my wife. I didn't want to have a very negative kind of a life, but I felt I was so shallow in my experiences, so needy to know what the underbelly of life was like. And so it was more of a mind experience of wanting to know other things without having the danger of going through them. And so I did have a talk with my wife, almost asking to get out of the marriage for a while. And she took it so casually because she knew I wasn't going anyplace. She knew me better than I did. And I kept saying, well, I think I'm going to leave. And she said, oh, that's okay. When do you want to go? And I was shocked and amazed by her attitude. And I knew how much smarter she was than me and how much better she was than me. And when I reached the point when I felt that I already had my freedom because she had given it to me. And I said, never mind. And I never went anyplace.
Your book ends with your first wife's death from cancer, and you explain in there that the doctor had told you that the cancer had metastasized,
yes,
and that she didn't have long to live, but you and your doctor agreed it might be best not to let her know that.
Well, we did tell her that she did have, the doctor did tell her that she had cancer, but he told me he was going to tell her that we had nipped it in the bud, that mm-hmm. it was caught, and that she was going to get through this. And he said to me, we have to give her hope. He says, however, the time will come. He says, because I don't think she has more than a year and a half. He said, she will tell you when it's the right time to talk about it. Only in the year and a half, she never did. But my children didn't know. And that was my greatest regret, that I never told the girls until the very end. My eldest daughter, Ellen, I did tell about a few weeks before it happened. My middle daughter, Nancy, when I say middle, I have another daughter now with my marriage, current marriage. Nancy didn't know until it was too late. I mean, she loved her mother dearly and just didn't know what was going on. She was only 10 years old, where Ellen did understand. Ellen knew it even before I told her.
It's always, I think, a hard decision for people to make, how much information to give a loved one about their own illness. Do you have any regrets about not having told the complete truth to your wife when she was sick?
Well, I kept waiting for her to talk about it. I did see her talk about it in various other ways. We moved up to the country for a while, and Joan would talk to Nancy and say, talk about the trees and the flowers, how they would all be replenished and how they all stay in this world and one nurtures the other thing. And so in her own way, she was saying to Nancy that I will not be gone. Maybe my body will be gone, but the rest of me, the spirit of me, won't be gone. She didn't put it in those words, but Nancy sort of understood that without knowing what was actually going to come.
You have a theory that you write about in the book, that your mind doesn't know when you're writing that it's only fiction. Your mind thinks you're actually living through whatever you're putting on paper.
Yes.
What has led you to this conclusion?
Because My body goes through the pain that I am going through in the writing. I feel the tenseness if I'm writing a scene between, let's say, a husband and wife who are having a fractious marriage, things are going wrong, there's a big argument, there's a confrontation. I feel the intensity in my body, and I don't think I'm acting that out. I truly feel it. I'm exhausted when I go home. Whereas if I write something that's a funnier scene, a lighter scene, a more loving, romantic scene, I don't feel that same tension. I feel a lightness about me. So I don't think that the mind differentiates about what's going on in real life or what's going on in the fiction you're writing.
So fiction really does take its toll on you physically.
It does, but it's been very rewarding for me. I don't think I would like to have been anything else in life but a writer, but I also don't think I could have been anything else.
Well, Neil Simon, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Neil Simon recorded in 1996. He's the winner of this year's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. The Kennedy Center ceremony was broadcast earlier this week on public television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's a song from a musical Neil Simon wrote the book for, Sweet Charity.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wowee, look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Every time it rains, I think of you.
The rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown died last week at the age of 78. She was one of Atlantic Records' first stars. Coming up, we listen back to our 1997 interview with her.
My love comes tumbling down and it's raining. Teardrops from my eyes. Well, if you see clouds here in my eyes, it's just
this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown died Friday at the age of 78 after suffering a heart attack and stroke following surgery. We're going to remember her today by listening back to a 1997 interview. Ruth Brown was nicknamed Miss Rhythm by the singer Frankie Lyman. She was one of Atlantic Records' first hit makers, and in the 1950s she was their most prolific and best-selling performer. She recorded over 80 songs for Atlantic between 1949 and 1962. Her best-known records include Teardrops from My Eyes, 5-10-15 Hours, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean, and Lucky Lips. Her 1958 recording, This Little Girl's Gone Rockin', has recently been used in a TV commercial for Hummer. Ruth Brown started her comeback in the 80s when she starred in the Broadway revue Black and Blue, for which she won a Tony Award. She also co-starred in John Waters' film Hairspray as Motormouth Mabel. In 1993, the year she turned 65, she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In addition to her hits, she's remembered in the music world for her successful efforts to recoup her royalties from Atlantic and to fight for royalty reform for artists of her generation whose contracts came to be seen as exploitive. Let's start with her 1953 recording, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. Started singing in church.
Mm-hmm.
What was the church and what was the music?
Well, I started singing in church not necessarily because that was of my choosing, but that was the rule. You know, my dad, and coming from a Southern family, I don't know. I wouldn't say that because it was a Southern family that was the norm, but I think that practically any R&B artist, the most of us of my ethnic persuasion, started singing in the church. If indeed at all you did have any kind of a talent, the understanding was it was something that was God-given and you had to give that back. And so my father insisted that if I didn't sing in the church, I was not going to sing at all, you know.
So what kind of singing did you do in church?
Well, I was sort of twisted between my father's church was Methodist, and they have sort of just flat-footed inspirational spirituals, I call it. You know, His Eyes on the Sparrow and Precious Lord and those things. That was in my father's church. But now, on the other hand, in the summer when I went to North Carolina, which where my mother's people were, to work and sharecrop in the fields in the summer, we went to a Baptist church. And it was totally different. You know, in the Baptist church, we didn't have the big organ and all of that like we had in the Methodist church. The music was made by patting of the foot, clapping of the hands, and everything was just done with the human voice. And, of course, it was so joyous. And on the other side, if it wasn't joyous, it was so depressing. You know, there were songs like, "Sit down, sinner, you better sit down. Sit down, sinner, you better sit down. You ain't going to heaven, so you better sit down." If that didn't take your spirit away, nothing did, you know. And then on the other hand, you had, "I got shoes and you got shoes. All God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. Dance all over God's heaven." So in my father's church, I was christened because that was the way of the Methodists. But and my mother's and my grandmother in North Carolina, she insisted that unless you were submerged in the deep water, you hadn't done a thing. And so I stood on line at the creek and was submerged in water. So I was baptized, you know, so the Spirit had me on either side. So, you know.
No. But, mm-hmm. Another exposure to music you had was when you were in North Carolina for the summers working in the cotton fields. A lot of people sang and shouted there. Sing me some of the things you heard in the cotton fields.
Oh, my goodness. "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, and oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy on me. When the world's on fire, When the world's on fire, when the world's on fire, Lord have mercy, mercy on me. And then there was like this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Did you sing yourself when you were working in the field?
Oh, occasionally. But I think that by that time I had started to listen on the radios back in Virginia and hear some things that I wanted to really get into musically. Of course, I was exposed, first of all, to country and western before anything else, you know. And then after country and western, the war years, I listened to, like, the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby and Vaughn Monroe.
This is on the radio.
Oh, this is radio. Oh, yeah. Well, radio's always been the intermediary, you know. And one thing about radio was that it very possibly was one of the reasons that rhythm and blues, as I knew it, eventually turned into rock and roll. There had to be a change because what the kids were hearing, they had the privilege of turning that dial, listening to whatever they wanted to listen to without seeing the color of your skin or who you were or what you looked like. And they were dancing to the music. And so, just like in a lot of other things, this had to make some changes because now was going to be something that was exposed. People were dancing, even though they had ropes down the center of the barnyards and all. When I played the dances, the ropes fell down lots of times, and the white kids and black kids danced together. Nobody said a thing about it until some big official, a sheriff or something, would come up and say, stop the music and put the ropes back in place. So the music itself had already started to become the common denominator, you know?
We're listening to a 1997 interview with R&B singer Ruth Brown. She died last week at the age of 78. We'll get back to the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering the rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. She died last week at the age of 78. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with her in 1997. Ruth Brown, you started your singing career singing at USO clubs.
Yes.
Was this during World War II or after?
Yes, this was, well, it was between 1941 and 1945, you know, which was Pearl Harbor, was December 7, 1941. And these were the war years.
Well, you were a teenager.
I was indeed.
Your early teens during part
indeed
of this.
Indeed I was.
So what was it like for you as a young teenager to be singing for soldiers?
Well, to tell you the truth, I sort of snuck in to sing with the soldiers. My dad didn't know it in the beginning because I had gotten a job working at the USO, working behind the soda fountain. And so I was allowed to go into the USO because I had a part-time job in there, so everybody thought. But my basic reasons was to get in and work and sing with that little USO show that was rehearsing there quite often. And a number of times, and I was supposed to have been in choir practice on Thursdays, I was up with the USO show. You know.
So what'd your father do when he found out?
Singing. And my dad walked in one night. Oh, sure. Somebody told him. And he walked in one night unannounced. And I was up on stage. I'll never forget. I was singing Chattanooga Choo Choo. And I tell you, my dad was that person, you know. He just didn't have to say a word. He had a look about him, you know. And there was something in his stride, you know, when he walked. There was like you talk about body language, it was body language. And all he did was walk to the edge of the stage and look straight up at me and beckon. You know, he didn't open his mouth. All he did was come to the edge of the stage, beckon, and point, like with his finger, and say, come on down, you know. And you knew what he meant, and you knew what to expect when you got down off of that stage. But I met the force. May the force be with you. The force was with me even then when I came down, because my dad didn't even wait for me to get outside the building. He decided that if I had ignored him, then he was going to make what I had done public. And he gave me my whipping right there in public, you know. Of course, that didn't stop me. I kept sneaking around trying to sing with these shows, and did quite a few of them, you know, until I was just struggling to get to be of an eligible age, you know, when you get to be that 17 or 18, which I wasn't going to wait on anyway.
You say at some point that you realized that you could make more money singing two nights a week than your father could make working a full week.
That's right.
And I'm wondering, as a girl, what impact that realization had on you?
Well, it was really important because I was the oldest of 8 children, and being a girl had nothing to do with the fact that what your position in life was as the oldest. I was the first one that had to go to work. My dad was a dockhand and a laborer, and I think I remember going many times to pick up his paycheck or his little brown envelope with the monies in it. At that time, they didn't have checks. They just rolled up what little money they would do and put them in a little brown envelope, and that was it. And I know that he made up to $35 a week, which was big money for him. But when I went out and sang and earned $35 in one night, I knew that something here was wrong. You know, something was definitely wrong. And I'm sure that had it not been for the fact that he was a young father with all these children, if the opportunity had presented itself, he very possibly could have been a great singer, because he had a wonderful baritone voice. And I'm almost sure that sometimes now, since I've become a woman, an elderly woman now, and I look back on all of that, I realize he was probably very frustrated sometimes, because he saw in me a lot of what could have very possibly happened for him, you see?
You won one of the amateur nights at the Apollo sessions in, I guess it was the late 1940s.
Yes.
And then must have been 1948 or 49, Atlantic Records wanted to sign you. And they were going to bring you up north again, this time for a paid date at the Apollo.
Yes.
What happened to you when you were driving up north to play the Apollo?
Well, we were due to be at the Apollo that Thursday for a 3 o'clock in the afternoon rehearsal, which was what they did. And you rehearsed downstairs in a little place under the main theater. And we left Washington, D.C. En route to New York to be there in time for that rehearsal. And I would assume it was about, I guess, 8:45 in the morning of October 29th. I remember it well, outside of Chester, Pennsylvania. I'm still not sure what happened. Maybe the gentleman driving might have gone to sleep at the wheel. I don't know. All I know is that I remember a screeching of tires, and I remember a crash, you know, and I remember then finally hearing somebody say, the girl in the back is dead, and that they were talking about me. And they took everybody else out before they did me. And finally, when they came to move me, when they went to straighten my leg, my left leg had been broken 3 or 4 places and was back up under my body. They tried to straighten me out to pick me up, and that's when I screamed. And they realized that I was indeed not dead, just in a state of shock.
You were unable to talk until then?
Yes, I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak, whatever the reasons, and my vision, because the suitcase had fallen and hit me in the face and in the head. But I did end up in Chester Hospital and was there for 11 months and something. And once I was released after that period, in fact, my contract with Atlantic was signed while I was a patient in the hospital. they came over for my 20th birthday and brought the contracts, and I signed them on my bed in the hospital there at Chester. And when I finally did get out of the hospital, they brought me to Philadelphia, and I stayed up in North Philadelphia on Butler Street with Cab Calloway's sister, Blanche Calloway, for many, many months until I was able to manipulate around on some crutches, and then I started singing around Philadelphia and all the little clubs, you know.
I guess this brings us to your first record, made in 1949.
Yes.
For Atlantic Records. It was called So Long.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about your memories of this first recording.
I remember
session.
Going in the studio on crutches to do this tune.
So long. Hope we'll meet again someday. Oh, that maybe then you'll say, darling, I was wrong. So long. Gee, I hate to see you go. You're the world to me, you know. You've been mine so long. All alone.
When you became a rhythm and blues star, you toured with some of the rhythm and blues and rock and roll shows. And I'm wondering if you could give us a taste of what it was like for you as a performer to be in those rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was wonderful, but of course, they came along a little later. I think they started, there was a father and son team out of West Virginia who booked all those shows called the Super Shows. The Weinbergs were the promoters, and they put these shows together. They had this brilliant idea. And at one time, there were people on the bus like the Clovers, the Drifters, the Five Keys, Lester Young, Buddy Johnson's orchestra, Ella Johnson, and then you would have like a Sam Cooke, you know, and you would have a John Coltrane, and you would have Paul Huckabuck Williams and Charles Brown and Roy Brown, and sometimes there were about 10 acts on one bill, and the ticket only cost about $7.50, you know.
So you're saying,
but it was wonderful.
Did Lester Young share the bill with the Drifters and the Clovers?
Oh, of course, with me.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Must have been an awfully interesting bus ride.
It was interesting, but we were so young and naive, I didn't realize the greatness of a lot of these people I was working with. So,
was there ever a point during your adult life when you couldn't earn a living singing and you had to do other jobs?
Oh, yes, of course.
What did you
do? Of course. I did domestic work. I drove a school bus.
You did domestic work after you had rhythm and blues hits?
Oh, sure. This was during the 60s. That wasn't too long ago. This was during the 60s, the advent of the Beatles and the British invasion. And the business became a little more complicated. But that wasn't really the reason I left, because I really chose... somewhere down the line, it started to sort of ease back because I had two wonderful children and I wanted to spend more time where they were. And it went back a few years before that I thought of it, because my mother used to take care of my sons. And I remember coming home one time to visit. My only tie to my children had been material things, you know, things that you could send money home for and purchase gifts. And I came home, and my oldest, of course, was jovial and jumping up. But my baby, when I went to reach for my baby, he didn't want me to touch him, and he screamed and yelled, you know. And I think that was probably the first day that I said to myself, well, I got to do something about this. And that was one of the reasons that I finally decided to come in, so to speak. But in those times, I did many things. I did domestic work. I cooked. I worked in daycare. I worked in the home for retarded children. I worked in drug abuse as a counselor. I drove a school bus. I worked in Head Start. I worked wherever I could bring a paycheck home, you know.
Well, how did you feel after the adulation that you'd get on stage cleaning other people's houses?
Well, I didn't feel anything about it because what I was doing was earn a living, a clean, decent living. And it was what my mother had done all of her life, so I felt no shame about it because I did that with as much dignity as I do anything else. I did a good job. I was a good housekeeper, you know. And it wasn't until my needs were of such that I was cleaning house one day and I heard my music. I heard a disc jockey talking about my greatness and how great Ruth Brown was. And at that time, I think I was scrubbing a floor. And that is when I sort of made up my mind that there was some money that belonged to me that I had not been receiving. You know, I had not gotten a royalty statement in almost 30 years. I hadn't seen one, you know. And my records were being sold all over the other country, and he was talking about how big this was in Japan and in Germany, and I had no idea about this. So I began this battle, this uphill battle it was, to maintain and reclaim something that was really mine. I refused to beg because I was going to fight for I knew what was mine. You know, if these records are being sold, then I'm entitled to my part of whatever they're being sold for. Now, after all these years, I'm getting record royalties back again for the first time in many, many years, you know.
We're listening to a 1997 interview with singer Ruth Brown. She died last week at the age of 78. We'll get back to the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering the rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. She died last week at the age of 78. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with her in 1997. You made a comeback in the 80s with a series of music theater reviews, including Black and Blue. And I'm wondering now how, when you're performing on stage, the feeling and the audience compare with the earlier part of your career in the 50s?
It's kind of awesome. But the beautiful thing is that there are a lot of young faces out there that are now becoming aware of this music that I was a part of. And a lot of them, not because they knew my music, but I did another crazy thing one day. I did a film called Hairspray. And I gained a whole following of new young people with that crazy movie.
It's a great movie. It's a John Waters movie.
Yes, ma'am. With
about,
Ricky Lake.
Yeah, with Ricky Lake. It was her first big role.
Yes, yes.
And it's about one of those dance shows in Baltimore.
It was
kind of like
an
American Bandstand, but one set in Baltimore.
It was a real show. Yeah. I remember the reality of it. And it was in a time when John Waters was a young man. He grew up hearing that. And I remember those situations very, very well.
Uh-huh.
And I had said, well, I'm not going to do this film, especially when they took me to wardrobe and brought that white wig out. I said, not on your life, you know. But, of course, it was I can't call his name. He died.
Divine.
I call him the Divine. He came to me and said, girl, put that wig on your head and make some money. And I said to him, no, I'm going to lose every fan I've got in the world if I come out with this white wig. And Divine said, well, I tell you what, for every one you lose, I'm going to bring you two. And every time I see that film, and it runs continuously, and I've gone into grocery stores and see young people following me around, my ego says, oh, they know who I am, Ruth Brown, that kind of thing. And then they will eventually say, aren't you Motormouth Maybelle?
role in the movie.
That was my role and continues to be my claim to fame. You know, that cult film has really been wonderful. I go to the mailbox quite often now and find a little check with John Waters, God bless him, on it. He writes to me and sends me crazy Christmas cards and things until this day.
Well, Ruth Brown, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I've done all the talking, you see.
Ruth Brown, recorded in 1997. She died last week at the age of 78.
Along about the evening, I feel so blue. And though my heart is grieving, I'll wait for you. I'm writing you a letter.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Minhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. I'm Terry Gross.
You and I said our love would grow if you ever get the notion. You miss me too. Make it in a hurry.
Support for NPR comes from Guidepost Books, publisher of First Light, the early inspirational writings of Sue Monk Kidd. Available at Borders, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at wkkf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robin Williams on his life and his career. He's co-starring in the new animated Penguin movie, Happy Feet. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.